Morning, friends. So if you've been here the last couple weeks, you know we're in the middle of a series on conflict in the church, just hypothetically, if it was to ever come up. And so we've looked a little bit at Acts and the early church and sort of what happened through some of their early conflicts and the conversations they had and the process they went through to figure out how to do this work. And last week, we took some time to just sort of sit with James and hear James's take on why we have conflict. And today, we're going to look a little bit at 1 Corinthians. It's amazing how many letters that are written in the early church happen to be about conflict, and they stick around. So we're going to look at this 1 Corinthians letter. The church at Corinth is one we know quite a bit about comparatively to some of the others. There's a couple really long letters that the Apostle Paul wrote to the Corinthians, and we have those because that's 1 and 2 Corinthians. And we also know there were letters that went from Corinth to Paul because of the way that Paul talks to the Corinthians. It's obvious that he's responding to things. And Paul is the founding pastor of Corinth, so this is sort of the situation. This is who's talking to the Corinthians in the situation. Full disclosure, I'm not sure the Corinthians were always happy with the advice Paul gave them. Paul is at times stern and certainly doesn't hold anything back in advising this church that he knows and loves. And full disclosure for myself, I'm not always happy with Paul. I don't always like everything he has to say, but I also think Paul has a lot of good things to say, so I keep on wrestling with this, and maybe you've had that experience too. I want to suggest this morning that we look at Corinthians in a broad way, searching for main themes rather than honing in on a lot of specific advice. And I suggest this in part because I think Paul has several central themes that are critical for us to hear, and in part because when you read other people's mail, sometimes you get into other people's business that really isn't your own, and stuff you don't have context to understand. Of course, we don't act as if everything in Corinthians is directed specifically at us. For example, when was the last wedding you were at when the officiant quoted 1 Corinthians 7:9? But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. And then ask before moving forward with the ceremony if the couple was sure that they couldn't control themselves and resist their burning passion for each other. We don't do that. And I'm not suggesting by any means that we not take 1 Corinthians seriously. Rather, that there's a lot to study and sort through and think on in Corinthians. But some of it's not really what we'll find helpful in looking at how to deal with conflict in the church. And I firmly believe that there are some central themes here that can be really helpful in our faithfulness. And Paul doesn't waste any time. He hops right in with the conflict. He says this in verse 10 of chapter 1. I have a serious concern with you, my friends, using the authority of Jesus our Master, and I'll put it as urgently as I can. You must get along with each other. You must learn to be considerate of one another, cultivating a life in common. At the heart of this letter, Paul, as always, is concerned for the unity of the church, and it doesn't take Paul long to get to the core of what unity looks like. What the core of what it means to be part of the church is this, it's the cross. Paul says it this way, I didn't try to impress you with polished speeches and latest philosophy. I deliberately kept it plain and simple. First Jesus and who he is, then Jesus and what he did. Jesus crucified. For Paul, this is super clear and simple. It's not about being right and impressive in philosophy or making astounding theological arguments, but instead it's a way of living. And I read in my preparation for this that, you know, Paul, by the time he was 20, had the equivalent of 2 PhDs in theology. So he could have not kept it simple, but he chose to do so. So Paul is saying this is about being transformed into what God intends us to be. With the unsurprising message that we seem to hear over and over again, that we have to die to ourselves to allow Christ to live through us. Richard Rohr puts it this way, the cross is a transformational image and message that utterly rearranges one's reality and the idea of the very nature of God. Evil is not overcome by attack or even avoidance. but by union at a higher level. It is overcome not by fight or flight, but rather by fusion. This is a fusion of ourselves and God. We aren't faithful by demanding our own way or by fighting harder for our cause. We're faithful when we let go of our lives, even our most pressing concerns, and allow the mind of Christ to guide us. N.T. Wright suggests this about the cross. Most Western Christians have been taught that Jesus died so they could escape the result of sin and go to heaven after they die. The New Testament, however, regularly speaks of Jesus' death as the defeat of the powers of evil that have kept the world in captivity, with the implication that the world is actually going to change as a result through the life and work and witness of those who believe this good news. We have been so seduced by the Platonic vision of heaven that the resurrection of Jesus is simply seen as a happy ending after the crucifixion and as the prelude to his going to heaven so that we can go and join him there later. This misses the central point that the resurrection of Jesus is the beginning of the new creation in which we are to share already in the power of the Spirit. This affects everything, from prayer and the sacraments to mission and service to the poor. Paul is directing the Corinthians in their conflict and in turn us to the core of transformation, which is obedience to the work of the Spirit in us, made possible by our willingness to accept the sacrifice of Jesus and follow that example. Friends, we live in the power of the new creation. If we're willing to accept it, if we're willing to sacrifice our own stuff and allow the Spirit to live in and through us. And I won't suggest this is easy, but it is the heart of what it means to accept the way of the cross. Frederick Buechner reflects, "I will ask you a terrible question, and God knows I ask it of myself. Is the truth beyond all truths, beyond the stars, just this, that to live without Christ is the real death, and that to die with Christ is the only life?" Buechner is reflecting what Paul sets up in this letter to the Corinthians from the very beginning as the paradigm. We are called to die with Christ in order to find life on the other side. And this foundation is what guides the rest of this letter, which deals very specifically with the conflict in Corinth. So Paul doesn't leave this idea of the transformed life as abstract, but directly deals with multiple issues in the church. So if we're tempted in conflict to ignore the problems that are happening or tiptoe around them, we don't have much of a basis from Paul's writing. Paul says there's things that are happening in the Corinthians church, things like sleeping with your stepmom, for example, that simply aren't okay. Being promiscuous or greedy or predatory or false, these aren't okay. They don't look like being transformed to the image of God, and it's our responsibility as a community to deal with these kind of issues. Paul makes this really clear in chapter 5. We're called to hold each other to be true to that of God in us, not as some legalism, but as members of the same body working towards our health together. And Paul addresses multiple other issues, covering how to bear with one another in matters of disagreement that aren't central, but there are strong feelings about, or how to balance freedom and responsibility, how to honor one another and honor Christ, how to be in community with one another and bring your gifts to that community. There is the beautiful language of chapter 12 as how we're all interconnected. And as I looked at all of this, I noticed this really interesting phrase at the end of chapter 12, and maybe you've noticed it before too. Paul says, after all of this really good advice, "But now I want to lay out a far better way for you." Paul takes all that he's talked about and frames it so the next piece he lays out in chapter 13, the love chapter, transforms all of it. This is what it looks like to be the people of God, to love like this. Now, I mentioned earlier that you don't often hear 1 Corinthians 7:9 quoted at weddings, But we often quote 1 Corinthians 13, which is not a bad thing. But it happens so often, I wonder if we've relegated this advice that Paul gives, so clearly meant for the church and its interaction with each other, to only our marital relationships. And I wonder if we've done that because the far better way that's laid out in chapter 13 will demand of us that we really do die to self. We've heard these words so many times, maybe they float past us too easily. But Paul describes love, the actualization of Christ living in us, like this. Love never gives up. Love cares more for others than for self. Love doesn't want what it doesn't have. Love doesn't strut, doesn't have a swelled head, doesn't force itself on others, isn't always me first, doesn't fly off the handle, doesn't keep score of the sins of others, doesn't revel when others grovel, takes pleasure in the flowering of truth, puts up with anything, trusts God always, always looks for the best, never looks back, but keeps going to the end. And maybe this feels too hard. With our misunderstanding of God's grace, meaning that we can't ever mess up again now that we love Jesus, instead of recognizing that loving and trusting Jesus means we have freedom to fail, we read this list as an indictment rather than the hope of how our lives can be transformed. And of course, the freedom in this is that the fruit doesn't have to grow itself. The tree nurtures and cares for it and creates it naturally and organically. We become more and more like this list as we die more and more to ourselves. And I don't think this list is meant to shame us into being different. I don't think this list is the unattainable ideal, but a pragmatic foundation for what it means to be God's people. Remember, the chapter begins with these words: if I speak with human eloquence and angelic ecstasy, but I don't love, I'm nothing but a clanging gong or crashing cymbal. If I speak God's word with power, revealing all God's mysteries and making everything else plain as day, and if I have faith that says to the mountain, jump, and it jumps, but I don't love, I'm nothing. If I give everything I own to the poor and even go to the stake to be burned as a martyr, but I don't love, I've gotten nowhere. So no matter what I say, what I believe, and what I do, I'm bankrupt without love. These don't sound to me like words of some unrelated utopian ideology, but the core of the message, the core of what our lives are called to look like. Remember, this is written to a church that is mired in conflict with real and pressing issues. They'd had far too much gong-related violence, and so have we, when we speak without love. And we know how it is to be treated without love. We have suffered the consequence of the violence that is done to our hearts and minds and souls when people forget that love is the core of our life together. But we're also often reticent to accept that this could be real, that this is accomplishable. We assume that to love in this way is simply to make nice rather than address difficult issues. But nothing could be further from the truth. When we make that assumption, we continue to buy into the dominant ideology of our culture, that we somehow have to win or dominate in order to bring about change. We refuse, as Richard Rohr put it, to utterly rearrange our reality and idea of the very nature of God. And so we ignore the call to transformation of ourselves and our world as Christ models and calls us. So what if we did take this call to transformation seriously? What would the characteristics of what love would look like in our lives work out to be? So I wonder if we might, as a prayer practice, read through this a couple of times. And the first time, put your name in instead of love. Nate never gives up. Nate cares more for others than for self. I'm going to assume, because it happens to me, that you might notice places where you might not fully live up to that statement. So let me invite you to be gentle with yourself. Rather than using this as an occasion to belittle yourself, use it as an occasion to pray for God's work in your life. Maybe using the prompt, God help me to never give up, to care more for myself than others. So let's practice. There's a fill in the blank there for your help. Let's go. Nate never gives up.
Doesn't keep score of the sins of others. Doesn't revel in others' problems. Takes pleasure in flowering of the tree. Puts up with anything. Trusts God always. Always looks for the best. Never looks back. But keeps going to the end.
I'm going to suspect that we have some room to grow. And I hope we can hold that loosely. I hope we can hold that loosely. Because I don't think the intention in any of this is to walk away going, oh, there's no way we can do this. I think the intention is the opposite. That we can, in fact, become this. But we've told ourselves for so long that we can't. And our culture tells us that if you do this, it won't work, that we bought that. And, you know, the reason that we use this language of dying to self is I think it means we actually do have to die to ourselves. And that's not language that sounds particularly easy. But I think it's critical to us becoming who we're called to be. I also recognize that this is a letter that's not written just to individuals, but to a group of people, to a body of people. This isn't just me. This is us. This is us that's called to this truth. So let's pray it together, and let's put in the word North Valley. North Valley never gives up. North Valley cares more for others than for self. North Valley doesn't want what it doesn't have. North Valley doesn't strut, doesn't have a swelled head, doesn't force itself on others, isn't always me first, doesn't fly off the handle, doesn't keep score of the sins of others, doesn't revel when others grovel. North Valley takes pleasure in the flowering of truth, puts up with anything, trusts God always. Always looks for the best, never looks back, but keeps going to the end. Friends, I hope this is what we can be. More than anything else, I hope for us, I hope this is who we can be. So let's take some time to listen to Christ together. And if Jesus has a message through you to the rest of us, we'd ask that you'd stand and a mic will be brought so we can hear that message clearly. Let's listen well.